Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Welcome to this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar by Bipolar UK. And in this episode, it's a little bit different. We have a family member, a father of a son, and his son lives with bipolar. And his name is Paul. So welcome, Paul. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm just... I'd love you to introduce yourself in your own words and tell us a little bit about how you guys find yourself as a family in this space, caring for someone, supporting someone living with bipolar.
Okay. My name's Paul. I have three children. Our youngest is suffering with bipolar. He's probably been showing signs for the last 13 years. But it all really came to a head in 2019 when he was sectioned under the Mental Health Act in June that year. His family's really supportive. I'm not with his mother any longer. I've remarried, but we still stay very close. His sister and his brother are so supportive of him. His mother is as supportive as I am, I hope. That sounds right in terms of our support towards our son. But it's been really hard for the last, certainly for the last 3 years, and it continues. He was sectioned again in August last year, spent 58 days in various wards, intensive care for a long time as well. So things were not good. He's back. He's out of hospital. He's a lot better. He has a very supportive girlfriend who's living with him. It's been exciting times. The hope is that we can find the way for him to be able to manage his bipolar. And obviously that's his hope, but he's impatient to get better. And it's not always easy for family members to talk to him. For me to be able to counsel Sam is really difficult. It's a really difficult thing to do. And I think that's because we're all too close. Well, in a nutshell, that's where we sit at the moment.
I think it is incredibly difficult for people that are very close to the person sometimes to be able to get to them when they're trying to communicate with them, when they're trying to be heard. And I think it's very hard. And like anything, right, sometimes it's so much easier to just talk to a complete stranger, isn't it?
Oh yes, I think for him to be able to do that as well is, but it's finding that right person too. Whether it's a psychiatrist, whether it's a therapist, you can't see that person all the time on a very regular basis. You're making appointments, and again, the impatience of my son towards getting better, or where he feels he can be in a position where he can manage the bipolar, is really frustrating for him. Mm-hmm. And all we can do as family is try and fill in those gaps, but of course that's not always what he wants to hear either.
No, it's very hard, and I live with bipolar, and I find it very difficult to. Those that don't live with bipolar, it's very difficult for them to really understand what it's like. So, for example, if I have a conversation with someone else who's got bipolar, there's so much that I don't need to say within a conversation to be understood. Yeah. And So it's very difficult, I think, for the people around us. And the people around us can be very patient and very supportive, and still, you can still feel like we're on different planets. It's so tough for everyone.
I mean, I got with through Bipolar UK, they gave me a contact of someone who has bipolar, who they felt might be very similar to, and get him to interact with that person, which he's done, and they've met, and they do talk and email, WhatsApp, whatever the communication is. I'm very good at that sort of thing. Obviously, I'm technically astute, not. And I think for him to be able to talk to someone who has the same condition is brilliant.
It is. It is
absolutely brilliant. But you have to find that person. Mm-hmm. And of course, bipolar affects people, I think, in different ways.
Absolutely does. Really does. And depending, sometimes you can be very, very unwell, and sometimes you can be very, very stable. And I noted what you said there, that you feel that your son has some frustration coming through with his journey and getting better. And it always makes me, so I think about that type of thing a lot, because when I first got diagnosed, I had the mindset that I was going to do all the things, I was going to get better, I was going to beat this, and life is going to be normal. And that's just not how this goes. And it was really, you know, it was a massive unlearning for me to learn that I wasn't going to get better and fix it and get over it. I had to like you've got to learn how to like rewire your whole life, you know, and live with, cohabit with, become friends with, respectful of. And then there's moments where you're stable, and then there's moments where perhaps you're unwell, you know. And it's I just find the language around it quite interesting, because to me, I used a lot of language, like when I first got poorly, well, when I first got diagnosed poorly, I was poorly before, right? But it just was not diagnosed, which I'm interested to hear your views on that in a minute from as a family member. And, but the first thing was, I'm going to beat this. I've got to do this, get better, like, you know. And then it's 11 years ago for me now since diagnosis. And that really did change over time, where it became more of a gentler approach of, actually, I'm not going to beat this. I've got to learn to live with it so I can be as stable as possible, right? And I'm not going to get better from it. I'm just going to be stable or unstable. Like,
but I use the word better. I mean, that's when it's so difficult, because I have to try and, all the time with my son, I have to try and find the right words that don't create an issue, don't cause upset, which I don't mean to do. All I want to do is support him and help him to get to that point where it's not getting better, it's getting where you can manage it.
Yeah.
And I think manage is the right word, and know that there are going to be there are peaks and there are troughs.
There are.
And it's, but bringing the troughs up and bringing the peaks down, finding that middle level,
which is trying to be more stable, and find a place of a bit more neutrality, which is difficult, and you know, doable. And it changes, it ebbs and flows, because as we go through life, different things come up, different things, big life events or loss, or you know, and all of a sudden you could be stable and something big could happen, and that could be a trigger to becoming unstable again and unwell. So it's not like a one-time thing, you know, because as our life changes, we change. And, you know, so it's this dance, it's this very complicated dance living with bipolar.
I think as a family member, when he started showing signs, and again, you don't know what bipolar is. You don't go, oh, he's showing signs of something, so he's obviously bipolar. That doesn't happen. You don't understand what that is. you know, you don't bring it into the equation.
Well, it's not in your awareness as even a thing, right? So how can you be aware of something you're not aware of?
Absolutely, until it gets to an absolute crescendo where suddenly police get involved and it's sectioning, and then in hospital somebody says, well, this is blatantly obviously he's bipolar. But even then, he's fighting it. I don't have bipolar. There's nothing wrong with me. It's you lot who are all wrong.
When he's poorly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was when it happened originally, when it got to that section point. It's why you've put me in here. There's nothing wrong with me. And I understand that now. I didn't know what was happening at the time, but you try and understand that. But I still, it's not in my head. No. I don't have the condition. So listening to him, it's a matter of trying to control your own emotion in trying to help to gain that understanding from him as to how he's feeling. And that changes day to day. And all we do as a family is love the guy and be there for him whenever we can be. But sometimes that's it. He just doesn't want us there. In fact, after the last section, when he was released, and he knows, and actually the team at the hospital know, he was probably released a bit too early, but there are other issues on a ward that they needed him out because they weren't conducive to his recovery, let's put it that way. And he came out of hospital and he didn't want anything to do with the family for 5 weeks. And that was horrible. But we all respected what he wanted. And so we didn't. And then eventually he made the call and said, I think we need to talk. And we were all there and we were all ready to talk. But again, it's still hard to find that, to make suggestions, to try and find another means, another psychiatrist, another therapy, another treatment, whatever. We are all trying to help, but actually the only person who's going to find the best way is my son, not us.
No, it's so hard. So let's go back a little bit, because he was diagnosed in 2019. But from your point of view, because I ask this to people that live with bipolar, I ask these two questions. When were you diagnosed? Versus when do you think bipolar first affected your life? And often the answers, not always, but often the answers are different. So I'm curious to kind of put that same question to you. So he was diagnosed in 2019, but as his dad, when do you feel bipolar really first had a big impact on his life? When do you think that was?
I think it was probably when he was 18, 19.
Okay.
I mean, that's when he believes it started to manifest. But of course, we didn't know what was manifesting. I had a couple of times that I always remember where we were all meeting with my brother and his family, and the cousins, we all get on very well. And we were meeting to have a meal in town and then go to the cinema. And Sam didn't show up for the meal, and then and I couldn't understand why, and we ended up, him and me, not going to the cinema, and I drove to a remote part of town where other people went around, and we shouted at each other for half an hour, just screamed at each other. I think was that part of the start. I don't know, but little snippets in memory just come back and you go, what's that to do with what we find ourselves in now? I don't know, but it was one point in my life that I'll never forget. It was horrible. But not understanding you just think there's a guy who's misbehaving,
mm-hmm.
And shouldn't be.
Yeah.
There was no reason for it. You know, loving family, good schooling, all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get to why. But mm-hmm. that's why, I mean, and it probably advances our conversation a bit, but I think with bipolar, there's not enough. Can I give you something that sort of always sticks with me? I have MS, I have multiple sclerosis. I was okay. diagnosed when I was 32, so nearly 5 years ago.
5 years ago, we'll go with that.
Yeah, let's go with that. no, but I've had it for 32.
He's a very young dad, guys.
That's one. I had it for, oh yes, that's right. Like 32, but my God, he's been, thanks for spotting that deliberate mistake. Anyway, but I've 32 years, but when I was diagnosed, somebody said to me, you know, I'm terribly sorry, you've got multiple sclerosis. I hadn't got a clue what it was. Mm-hmm. And that person, they didn't tell me what it was.
Mm-hmm.
They just sat there and said, you've got multiple sclerosis. You must have lots of questions. And I thought, well,
what do you ask?
How long have I got?
Yeah.
But there was an advertising campaign at the time. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 32 years ago, where there were big billboard posters with a man with just a photograph, black and white photograph of a man with the back torn out of the picture.
Okay.
It was, and all I remember is that was MS. That was from the MS Society. And I sort of thought, well, there is something out there that I can go to and mm-hmm. find out what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
But when, because as I say, when I was diagnosed, I hadn't got a clue. I remember leaving the surgery in Harley Street, where I'd been to see this chap, and I went to W.H. Smith's at Waterloo Station and found a medical dictionary so I could look it up. That's what it was, because you don't sort of sit there. And at my point, I wasn't going to go, oh, what is that exactly? Because, and he was probably looking at his watch going, you know, I've got the next patient coming in. And so with bipolar, somehow, mental health is in such, it's so big in the news at the moment,
mm-hmm.
that somehow if there was a big advertising campaign or something out there that said, do you feel like this or like this mm-hmm. or like this,
mm-hmm.
that these symptoms may be bipolar.
Yeah.
But for me and the family, when my son started showing signs, we had no idea. Now we can go, oh yes, well of course it started 10 years ago. It probably did. He believes he's been 13 years in the making, if you like, to then get to this point where you've over 2 or 3 years he's been sectioned twice. It's really unpleasant, as you know, I don't know, but it's, you know, he's going through hell. The last thing you want is for him to be sitting in a mental hospital in a ward, and certainly in ICU. It's horrible. So it must be dreadful for him. And actually, I'm not sure, although that they've been very well, it's not really helping him to be in that environment. And when the medication he believes doesn't work, then
at all, no. Or some,
well, you know, the last time he was in various wards for 58 days.
Mm-hmm.
58 days, and as my daughter said, it's probably the drugs that they put him on at that point, they didn't help. He just went through the high and started coming down the other side naturally within that period of time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. He doesn't know. None of us know. But it's cruel. It's cruel on the person. Yeah, it's cruel on the family. But we've got to be there for him. And we will always do that.
It's so... I mean, I left home at 15, and so therefore my whole bipolar journey took place way beyond when I was kind of in with the family setting. So I can't relate to your family dynamic around your son having bipolar. So it's interesting for me to hear how that's been for you all, because obviously my experience has been quite different. But what I can hear is that it really is impactful. And when he first was diagnosed, what was your first thoughts, feelings, fears?
I guess when he was first officially diagnosed was when he was sectioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd had a horrible build-up to that. He before he was sectioned that first time, he actually ran away. He was 27, 28, but he disappeared. I mean, we're pretty close, but he disappeared to Stoke, which we're not really sure why he picked on Stoke. He had a journey around the Stoke area. He booked himself into a hotel. He met a girl up there, which was fine. But he then started buying cars there. Bought two cars at significant cost, because they're all obviously both on finance agreements. Mm-hmm. He wasn't working, so there was no income. He owns his own house, which, in hindsight, it's something that he's been lucky enough to be able to have that. And that has been the cause, I think, of a lot of financial problems, because he has that house.
Okay.
So when people check credit scores and things like that, he owns his own home.
Yeah.
Free of mortgage. And so they're money, the people will give money willy-nilly. But so the Stoke episode, he came back. It was pretty fraught that in the end he was seeing a psychologist at the time and in central London, and we tried to meet him up there. He didn't know, but we knew he had an appointment. So myself and his mum and his brother and sister, we were in a car, we were sitting waiting outside this guy's offices so that we could see him before he went in. And that was the start of a week that I'll never forget, but at the end of which he was sectioned. He was picked up by the police. So that was the original formal diagnosis. Once he'd gone into hospital, they said he's got bipolar.
So you said that he was on his way to see a psychologist, but he wasn't diagnosed at that time. You didn't know it was bipolar at that time. So what was the kind of thought process between seeing the psychologist at that time, just because there were things going on that didn't understand, or what was going on?
Well, because he was, before he went to Stoke on his first adventure, he was, obviously things weren't right. Mm. And this was someone that his mother had been seeing for different issues. Mm-hmm. And so she said, well, why don't you go and see this person and see if it'll help? And she saw them for a year or more. I mean, if I go back, because it's recollection, I did, when things weren't working, I did suggest that he went to see a psychiatrist, and he ended up seeing two or three psychiatrists,
mm-hmm.
who he just didn't get on with. Mm-hmm. Then he stuck with one for a year, but that was after he was diagnosed. God, my memory is terrible, but he spent time in the Priory.
Mm-hmm.
He had a week, a month, 5 weeks in there. Various, he's, when he gets to a point where he's willing to try things, then that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But that's on the downward spiral. Mm. And ultimately you get to that point where he's not going to come out from under the duvet.
I know how that feels.
It's crazy. When I went to the interim the announcement, the report from the bipolar commission.
At the
Palace of Westminster,
mm-hmm.
or in Portcullis House, and I didn't sit on the panel. My daughter sat on the panel.
Mm-hmm.
As what I'm doing now. She was the family member who had another sibling who had bipolar, and I'd not met people before who'd had bipolar other than hospital.
Okay.
And I never actually met the people who also had bipolar in there. There were, I mean, various mental issues. But when we sat down and they had a panel discussion, and there was a young lady on the panel who's a reporter. She's works for a newspaper.
Okay.
And she started talking. And I just looked across at my daughter who was sitting next to her. And my daughter's face had dropped, and I just went, it's us, it's my son. It's exactly the same story this girl started telling.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same, that had gone away, but was, I mean, she quoted one situation where she gave money to a homeless person. That's exactly what my son did.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to solve the homeless crisis within 10 years.
Yeah.
So there's a homeless man in Stoke who got £2,000.
Oh, gosh.
Which is, I mean, good for him. I just hope he used it to his benefit. But it was £2,000 that my son didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about those two cars. That took me, because once he was sectioned, that took me 2-3 months to get out of those finance arrangements. And I complained bitterly to the banks,
mm-hmm.
because it was the same garage, used two different banks 3 days apart to buy cars. I mean, if you think finance agreements are £500 a month per car for 4 years.
Oh my gosh.
That's frightening, certainly when there's no income coming in. And why do you want two cars?
Exactly.
And they weren't cheap cars. And they took a car he had that was perfectly all right and took that as part exchange as well.
Oh, no.
So, that car was lost, but I got out of the finance agreements. But that was a fight. That was a fight.
There's so much fallout from being unwell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this horrible domino effect, and it just keeps going and going, or can keep going and going and going. And the impact, has a far reach. So he was sectioned that week. And then you say he was sectioned again in 2021. So did he have a period of being stable, and how did that look? And post-diagnosis, how did you feel? Were you relieved as a family to have an answer to what was going on? Or,
well, I suppose it gave us something to work with.
Yeah.
I don't think we were relieved. We just wanted to get him into a better place.
Yeah.
And he wanted to get into a better place, obviously. But you go through... I mean, he was the first time he went in June, and he came out in beginning of August that year. And he was okay. To be honest, I can't remember how he felt, other than he spent a lot of time at home with his mother, which was great in one respect.
Mm-hmm.
He went walking. He actually He actually walked over 1,000 miles. We timed him in the
end.
Oh my gosh. And he wouldn't do it for I said, well, you've got to do it for charity. And he said, no, I just want to walk. It just gets me out and I think about nothing and just walk.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. That's actually why I got involved in Bipolar UK originally.
Is it? Because
I said to him, look, you walk 1,000 miles, I will pay, if you do the 1,000, I will pay £1 for every mile you walk. And so I ended up with, and I said, and then you tell me a charity that you'd like to contribute the money to. And he said, no, I'm not interested. Just going to walk. So I said, okay, well, I'll shoot. So anyway, we did Bipolar UK, got a lot of that.
That's just amazing.
That was something I wanted to do for him.
Yeah.
But he, at the time, it was just, I'm going to walk. I mean, it made him, he lost so much weight. He looked really fit and everything else. And then, because of course you will know that when you have bipolar, I think this is right. I don't have it, but you go to the depths of depression.
Yes.
And almost this last time, then the suicide discussion started to come into the equation. And all he wanted to be, and he would say, all I want to be is high. I want to be high. Wow. I want to be manic. Because when I'm there, I feel good.
Yeah.
The world is not in my way. I can do anything.
Oh, no, anything. Unstoppable. That's how you feel. You feel invincible, unstoppable, don't need sleep. Everything's amazing. And what a wonderful way to feel.
Yeah.
However,
it's dangerous.
Of course it is. And the higher you go, the lower you fall. I can completely relate to what your son has said. I just want to feel like that, because I tell you, that is like, there's nothing, at least then you can get up, get dressed, go out, do things, right? It might not be well, but being in that absolute depths of despair, feeling suicidal, I mean, you do anything not to feel like that. Yeah. Both are unwell is the truth, right? Both are unwell. One just at the time feels easier than the other. But the real truth is both are not well. It's just incredibly difficult to see that when you're the one in it. / impossible. It's really hard. And for me, I rely on my husband. I rely on my best friends to call out the red flags and be like, you know, is everything okay? You know, do we need to, they, you know, what they say to me is, do we need to have a big sleep soon? Do we need to, like, they try to slow me down, they put the reins on me, come back? You know, it's very difficult. And of course, when you're like that, you just think, oh gosh, thank goodness. You know, that's not how I'm feeling right now. And I feel great and the world's great and everything's wonderful. So of course I can understand why people that live with bipolar, me included, much prefer hanging on to that part. But then it does tip over into agitation, aggression. I could argue with a paper bag, you know, when it tips over, you know, there's almost like a sweet spot and then it goes too far. And that's actually not all rainbows and sunshine and glitter. It can be a very stressful place, you know, and paranoia, delusions, you know, this.
How do you manage yourself out of that? Because you obviously do. I mean, that's where my son gets to that peak.
Mm.
And twice now it's boiled over. It's being able to manage that, to go, although I want to be up there, I have to know. And I guess, is it by just the experience of getting to that point where your aggression and your anger has built up to such an extent that you end up going over the top and section is involved?
Yeah. I mean, I've not been sectioned before, although I was told that 6 months before I got diagnosed, if I'd had access to a psychiatrist they would have.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get access. I was on a 6-month waiting list. So I ended up, you know, going all over the show and ended up being suicidal on the drop off on the end, right? But it's taken me a long time, and I think everyone's different. For me, in answer to your question, if I have to spot things way before, you know, like safety plans in place are really important. And that safety plan shared with my nearest and dearest people, and I've signed it at the bottom. So it's giving them permission to call me out on my stuff, which is hard to hear. I don't like to hear it. I get very frustrated when I hear it because I feel like everyone's in my way. Everyone's going too slow. You're all getting in my way. You're just trying to ruin me having a happy time when I've, you know, like, can't you just let me be happy when I've spent so long feeling like crap? And here you are now telling me that I'm too happy, you know, so that it's difficult. It's very difficult. I'm very difficult. And that is very difficult for my nearest and dearest too, because.
Are you very difficult? My son said something to me after the first time he was sectioned. He said, "Dad, I'm really sorry, but I can't apologize. Because it's not me, it's the illness." And I've always believed that that's true, because I know what he's like as a normal, wonderful son. And then with this illness taking hold, it's not him. It's not him talking.
You're not.
I hope it isn't. Not all the things he's called me. Anyway.
No, you're definitely not in your right mind, right?
Yeah.
I'm definitely not in my right mind.
It's not you. It's the illness that's.
If I was well and stable, that is not a way I would behave.
Yeah.
Emma with bipolar when she's unwell is very difficult to be around. It's very difficult to support. It's very difficult to love. People still love me. People still support me. I'm very grateful for that. But it's very difficult, and I'm not going to sit here and say it isn't, because I know it is. And you know, when you come back into a place and you think, oh God, you know, that wasn't great, you know, that was awful. And I mean, things are a lot better for me now, 11 years down the line, but you know, the first few years were incredibly hard, and the years prior to diagnosis were incredibly hard. Yeah. You know, and what happened before diagnosis is people thought, oh, that's just Emma, how she is, right? This is Emma. She's like here or she's here. She's bouncing off the walls or she's, you know, in the complete slumps. And so the truth was, it was causing difficulty throughout my life. I just didn't know. I didn't know what it was. So it just blended into being my personality. And then, of course, the more stable I get, the more I realize that's not my personality. And that is symptomatic of me being unwell. That doesn't detract from the fact that I'm incredibly difficult when I'm unwell. That's both are true. Both are true.
That's what I say. It's not you being incredibly difficult. It's the illness being incredibly difficult, which is driving that. That's the motor that's driving you at that moment.
Yeah. And it still makes it difficult for others to be around you, right? That's not an easy environment for people. It's not an easy environment for me to be in, living. And it's not an easy environment for the people that I love to keep leaning in and keep helping, you know, like when it's hard work, because it's hard work. Let's face it, it is. I often say having bipolar is like having a full-time job. You know, I think that managing bipolar for me, it's like a full-time job. Like, I have to think about everything. Yep. Every interaction I have, I sit and I think, oh, was that too much? Or was that okay? Is there anything in there I need to be aware of? And that's like going all the time. Everything I do, my work, my social life, everything. And just that alone is exhausting, that complete, like, you know, having to observe yourself all the time to check, where am I at? You know, is that an appropriate level of response to that situation? Or was that an elevated response? And is that a red flag for something I need to start being aware of? Do I need to start dialing it down? Do I need to start reducing my commitments? Do I need to book in my psychiatrist, change my meds? You know, so it's a full-time job for me, living with bipolar, I think.
But that's how you're managing it.
Yes.
And that's what my son has to, you know, he will develop that.
Yes.
Because each time he's been sectioned, he realizes what it's done and what it's meant.
That's it. It's awareness, right? Like you say, when you first get given a diagnosis, if you're not even aware this condition exists, it's a lack of awareness. But it's no one's fault. Why should you know, right? When it wasn't even in your sphere of like knowing. And then it's the same, I think, for when you live with bipolar, piece by piece, layer by layer, your awareness just broadens on yourself. And it's different for everyone because it shows up in people so differently and impacts people's lives so differently. So all you can do is start to become really aware of when that episode happened. That was the impact, that was the fallout. Okay, what happened before? What was going on in the months or years, in the case for one of my terrible episodes, what was going on in the years before? What were the triggers? How could I have slowed that down? How could I have taken the pressure out? How could I have reduced stress somewhere? You know, and that's like, it's like collecting data on yourself. That's how I view it. I view my life like living with bipolar is I've got to collect as much data on myself so that in the future I can counteract that trend. Yeah. And that's really it for me.
But it's being able to do that and having that awareness to do that. Yeah. And then being able to pick up your life and say, and I'm going to go and work and I'm going to go and see friends. Because that's, I think, my son's fear. And it's true. Some people, his family and his very close friends completely understand and will do whatever they can to support, help, get involved in whatever way we can to help him. But there are some people who go, well, I don't understand what the bloody hell's wrong with him. And so I'm off. I don't need all that hassle.
Yeah.
And this time around, he's of an age where friends are getting married and he's missing the stags and he's missing the weddings and he's missing all this, which he acknowledges and he knows and he hates it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the windows of sanity, not sanity, that's the wrong word, but the windows of stability are shorter and shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to extend those windows and shrink the points where the low points and the high points.
I mean, it's very difficult. We talk about it a lot on the podcast. It takes time and getting that balance and with medication. I mean, I think it took me 3 or 4 years to get where I needed to be with my meds. I spent the first 2 years on antipsychotics and I was only awake 8 hours a day every day. It was completely limiting to life, to normal life. and it saved my life. It saved my life. It kept me alive. Now, it wasn't really much of a life to live, really, because I was like a complete zombie all of the time, which was, I don't know, it's not really living, right? And when you've spent your whole life feeling so much to then go to complete like boop, you know, like on a heart monitor where it's like boop, 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 and then it's like boop, that was my life, right? Flatline. And I'm like, okay, good, I'm alive, good, but I don't feel anything. I'm not sure I can live the rest of my life like this. And then, of course, we start to experiment on different medications. But that was after I'd gone into a lot of talk therapy, a lot of psychotherapy, a lot of all of these different type of therapies. Because I think when you're very, very unwell, you don't have, or I didn't have the capacity to be aware of myself. I didn't have the wherewithal to start unpicking my stuff because I was too unwell. I was so unstable. It was just keep me alive. How do I stay alive? That was it. That was the only thing on the agenda, staying alive. And then beyond that, when you reach a bit more stability and then you've had a bit of therapy and you start to unpick a few things and you think, right, okay, I'm ready to feel a bit more now, you know, or this is my experience. I'm ready to feel a little bit more now. I'm scared of feeling a bit more because am I going to feel so much? I'm going to end up unstable again and back in that place again, which is terrifying. You never want to end up back there. But bit by bit, you know, and then the crazy waves came and it took another 2 years to sort of find stability and find my groove and find the meds that were my go-to and have enough therapy under my belt to have enough awareness to spot my triggers, to be aware of my red flags, to, you know, be able to build a safety plan that I was willing to be confronted with, my own safety plan that I've signed myself, right? But I was willing to be confronted with it, even though it used to drive me crazy because I then used to use it as ammunition against the people saying, you're just trying to slow me down. But the truth was, it was my plan, right? So how can I argue with myself? It's very hard. I tried.
You should publish your plan. Well, but because you know, so much is... But again, what you're saying, I can see it in my son.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere we need to get to that point where he can mm-hmm. write down those red flags. Mm-hmm. He can write it down and sign it for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that the lady at the bipolar commission meeting mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and what you're saying mm-hmm. is it's a very, very, very similar
mm-hmm.
Place that you all get to. There may be slight tweaks in there, but it just rings, what you've said to me rings so many bells.
Mm-hmm.
And what that lady at the forum said was just a huge bell rang. And if my son can hear that and see that
mm-hmm.
and recognize it, then hopefully it will act for him the same way it's acted for you.
Yeah, and it just takes and
free him up, give him that opportunity to live life again.
And it takes time to find your groove. That's what I believe it is. You've got to find your groove. It takes time. It can take years. It took me years, and that doesn't mean that I'm always stable. That's not the case. It's just that I have more tools in my toolkit now. That's it, right? There's nothing special about what I do. It's just that you build more tools in your toolkit to bring out and use when you need them. And sometimes even those are not everything, but it's certainly better than where I was 11 years ago with no tools, no awareness, didn't even know what bipolar was, you know, and bipolar is literally running me. You know, it's not quite like that now, right? But it is very difficult to find that, and it has to change. So like for me, for example, I was able to go, I don't know, 5 years later, I was able to go back into a very high demanding, high pressured job that demanded an awful lot from me, travel, all of these things. But then this period of life that I'm in, the last 2 years, we're trying to have a family. We're going through IVF and we've, you know, lost a baby. And there's so many things going on. My life has had to change. There's no way I could be. It's like how much, I don't know, capacity is there for stress and triggers. And the truth is, when you live with bipolar, you have to be really, really mindful of how much you're going to allow to happen, right? What can you control and what can't you? So there's no way I could be in that high powered, stressful job and be dealing with IVF and be dealing with the grief of baby loss and, right? I'd be in hospital. I'd be so unwell. So I've had to change everything. I'm like, right, changing gears, this is clearly going to take so much of my coping ability to just get through this season of my life. So this season of my life's got to be dialed right down. And I've got to, like, it's almost like putting a life jacket on, right? I've got to, like, buffer these parts of my life and reduce them as much as possible, because I already know that I won't cope with it all. It will make me really unwell again.
But maybe the bipolar has given you the mental strength to handle these situations.
I mean, yeah.
Is that another way of looking at it? There's a positivity that you've fought so hard with bipolar that it's given you the strength mentally to handle. You know, I can't imagine again the loss of a baby or the stress of going through IVF treatment. I had friends in the day, they went through it, and things didn't work out, it's terrible. I hope it, but that strength that you have to handle that,
yeah,
on the back of what you've struggled with over so many years, must be, you could almost say, bipolar's given me that strength.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely so many things that are transferable into that space in terms of looking after yourself. But I think it's just like knowing that you can't do it all, right? I think this is really key. When you live with something like bipolar, it's, say a normal person's coping is 100%, right? When you live with bipolar, for me anyway, I wake up in the morning and I think, God, yeah, I'm probably already at 40 to 50% of my coping ability today, just living with bipolar and how I feel. So you have to be really careful about what else you're going to allow in, because I've only got 50% left, right? And if that job actually requires 80% of my overall energy, then maybe I can't do that. I'm going to have to look for something else, right? And so that's what I mean about dialing things up and dialing things down, depending on the season of life that you're in. You know, 2005, 5 years ago, I wasn't planning a family. We weren't going through IVF. So I had more to give in my working space, right? But now I've got to put nearly all of my energy there. So there's no way I would be able to stay well living with bipolar with this going on as well, if I also had that job going on. So it's like this sort of balancing act. But really, I think it's important to know that you've only got so much coping capacity. How much is already kind of allocated? And then just work with what you've got left. And that for me is like a way I sort of visualize of trying to stay well and trying not to overload, and also leaving some space for, you know, just to be, not completely maxing yourself out. Is really important.
That is something that, whether you have bipolar or not, a lot of people will struggle to recognize that. People do in everyday life overload themselves.
Yes.
And then they burn out.
Yes.
And you've made yourself manage and recognize that time. But people in business often go, oh, well, you know, I'll give it a bit more. I'll work till midnight tonight. Yeah. And actually, that doesn't help, because you probably stop working properly at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
And after that, you're just wasting time.
That's it.
So being able to manage that, being able to teach yourself how to do that, is brilliant.
I think it's even more critical, like what you say, like even just anybody normally who doesn't live with bipolar, that is a challenge. But that's why I think it's so critical for people that do live with a chronic mental health condition to really be truthful and get to work with what is my actual capacity for coping and how much of it is already used, and okay, I can only take that bit, the rest is gonna have to go because otherwise I'm going to end up unwell, right? And it's hard because you want to do all the things, especially when you're feeling great, and then it gets very frustrating, and then I feel very pissed off that I have bipolar, and I think, oh, because I know I could, but then truth is I could only do it for a couple of months and then it would all fall off, the wheels would fall off, nothing would happen, I'd end up letting people down on loads of stuff, you know. So it's very difficult, and it's definitely not something I learned in the first few years of being diagnosed, it took a long time. So, and then you said that your son got sectioned last year.
Yes.
Yeah.
August last year.
Mm-hmm. And where are things with him now?
He's home. He's obviously come right down. He's struggling. He's going lower. He has got some opportunities for a new regime that funnily enough, his local hospital or the authority where he was, it's in the same area where he was sectioned, spent time in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
In Lambeth, they've put together a scheme specifically for people with bipolar, and he was assessed yesterday, and they're having a meeting Monday and going to see where it goes. I don't know whether it will help him, but he was very positive about the meeting. So
amazing,
which is good. Yeah,
really good.
It's really good. We've got a contact with another psychiatrist who, the person we talked about earlier, who I spoke to and my son's been in touch with subsequently, who has bipolar, who absolutely raved about the psychiatrist he saw.
Yeah.
I've got that contact and my son's actually got an appointment to see him, but I don't think both will work together. So again, we're covering bases at the moment, but we see where this one takes us.
And what does this new regime kind of look like, and in terms of what they're proposing? Don't know yet.
I don't know yet. They've done the appraisal. He's very keen that he gets further ketamine treatment.
Okay,
which is, and apparently these guys have got a ketamine clinic within their organisation. I understood when he had the treatment originally, there was only one clinic in London that gave it, because it's all done intravenously.
Yes, okay.
And strict measures, and it's all very carefully monitored. It's really the treatment that he went through was for covers depression. Lifts you from depression. It's not a bipolar treatment. And that, I think I've probably said at the outset that he did it. It lifted him out of depression brilliantly, fantastic. Yeah. And then for about 6 weeks, he was really back to full form.
Mm-hmm.
But then it just took him higher.
And this was after was this after the first time he was sectioned, he had this treatment?
No, this is since the last.
Okay.
Now, where are we? No, this was before this was subsequent to the first section.
Okay.
But it was in last year. So okay. March last year, he was very depressed. April, May time, he had the ketamine treatment. It was five treatments over 2 weeks.
Okay.
That lifted him out of depression. It was great. But then whether or not he was going to go to a manic episode anyway, don't know. But he had about 6 weeks. I think I said to you before we started the podcast proper that he started doing podcasts of his own.
Yeah.
And I believe the first one, I was amazed. He was talking about his bipolar on his own. Just, this is what's happened to me. And I thought it was so brave of him to do that, because he was still, after the first time he said, he still really fought against having bipolar. He still wasn't quite going to believe it. And then I did a podcast with him. We went for a walk. I said, let's do what Claire Balding does on Radio 4. And she said, what's Radio 4? I said, well, let's just go for a walk. Take the dogs for a walk and just talk about. And they did it. And I thought it came out really well. Not for me, for him.
Yeah.
But to me, he did 7 or 8 these podcasts, which you could see the mania increasing.
Okay.
You could see his mood changing from normality to hyper.
Yeah.
And then that resulted in the section in August last year.
Okay.
Which, and that was 58 days is a long time in anybody's boat.
Yeah. So now new regime proposal, he's been accepted and they're thinking about doing this treatment with him again, but putting in precautions.
No. For... This ketamine treatment he had before was private.
Okay.
It was nothing to do with, and it probably wasn't managed well enough. In hindsight, it's a perfect science, but
yeah.
it did the trick in terms of lifting him out of depression, but it didn't necessarily help in terms of
mania management.
Mania.
No.
And this is, I don't know any more than he said to me yesterday that they have an opportunity to use ketamine.
Okay.
But whether or not that they will decide that that's the right thing for him, I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know. But they are going to put together a regime. So I'm told. I've read the paperwork and it talks about a lot of, I think, 20 face-to-face meetings, yeah. Therapies.
Amazing.
It's bringing the whole thing together.
Good. Good. Well, I hope that this all goes well and he can start to feel a bit lighter soon and not quite so low, because it is awful when you're stuck feeling low. Yeah.
Well, he's not too bad at the moment, and all I can say is the support is there to do whatever we can. And he's more and more aware of himself and where he is, which is good, and then that's all we can hope for.
Mm-hmm.
But that awareness, which you've talked about, that you discovered,
yep.
You found
step by step.
Yeah, he needs to, and he'll get there. He's a very strong guy. He's very intelligent. Yeah. Unfortunately, he's far too clever for me. But and obviously, that was his mother's side. I'll stick to it. But yeah.
Well,
but he's a great guy. He is a really, really great guy. And we just want him to get to that point when he can manage it for himself.
Yeah.
And he will. He'll get there.
He will. And it just comes step by step, you know, like this uncovering. You almost got to get to know yourself on a really different level than you've ever had to before. So step by step, right?
Right.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Paul. Thank you. It's been interesting. It's been recorded, so it's frightening. So what might come out. Hopefully you'll cut most of it.
No, I'm not going to cut most of it at all.
My picture of steam engines instead.
Thank you so much for today.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.